Last time we talked about the natures of artifacts, and I pointed out that they have a different nature from natural things, in that artifacts can have as their leading function some the properties, the laws of some aspect that is in which they function only passively. Natural things are not like that. Their nature is qualified by only by the aspects in which they function actively. And this becomes important for social theories because human communities are artifacts. People combine people to form a business, a school, a church, a labor union, any number of social institutions. And that's where we're headed. We're going to end up applying these new concepts that we've derived from Dooyeweerd's ontology in order to get a theory of the state. And it, too, is a social institution. It's the institution that has as its purpose the establishment and maintenance of a public legal order. Now, the term state can be confusing to people who live in the United States, because in that country, the subdivisions of the whole nation are called states, so it's confusing. But traditionally, the word state in English has meant the political institution in society, the ruling part of which is the government. That's where we're headed with all this. You can keep that in mind as we go. Now, one of the important things that comes up when we look at social institutions and how they're qualified, their foundational function and their leading function, is whether or not the people who participate in them are parts of the whole. Are human beings parts of the state? Are they parts of a family, parts of a church? And our Christian theory wants to vehemently reject that idea. Human beings are not just parts of any social institution. What then is their relationship to the rest of the institution? And that's what we're going to deal with today. The classical definition of one thing being part of another was given by Aristotle. X is a part of Y if X plays a role in the internal organization of Y and cannot come into existence apart from Y. That's the traditional definition. So, for example, a cell is part of a plant. The cell can't come into existence or function apart from the plant, and it plays a role in the internal organization of the plant. It works fine for cells and plants, but it doesn't work fine for humans and, say, their relationship to the state as an institution and to the government as a ruling body in the state. We need another kind of relationship between them in order to understand the true nature of what's going on there. So Dooyeweerd has proposed the concept of capsulate wholes. He calls this an encaptic relation. There are sometimes that wholes are formed not by parts, but by sub-wholes. Entire things that can exist apart from the relationship, from the greater whole, but which do play a role in the internal organization of it. I gave some examples of that before, and I'll repeat them and apply them to this point now. A bird can swallow a small stone. It can go into its gizzard and help grind its food. It's certainly taking part in the internal process of the bird. We could argue whether it really has a role in it, in its internal organization, but it seems to me it does. Nevertheless, it's not a part of the bird. And of course, on the traditional definition, it wouldn't be either, because the stone can exist apart from the bird, whereas the cell can't exist apart from the plant. But an encaptic relation, or a capsulate relation, is one in which the one whole, or many wholes, combine to form a larger. We could call it a super whole, a larger whole, and without ever being parts of it. So that's what we want to say about social communities. First of all, they are artifacts. looks like we need something else going here. Because humans form them. And secondly, if they are artifacts, they have a foundational and a leading function. We're going to say that for the state, for the political institution, the foundational function is historical. People come together, they in a state, and they acknowledge a leadership of that state. They acknowledge an authority. And the leading function is justice. Aristotle got it right. Justice is the bond that binds men into states. Then the question arises, are the citizens of the state parts of the state? And people like Aristotle and Karl Marx said, yes, they are. They're parts of the state because they function in its internal organization, and they cannot come into existence or function correctly apart from the state. This is a collectivist view of the state. The whole has priority over any individual part. Aristotle even makes the argument that just as a doctor will sacrifice a part of your body in order to save the rest, it may be necessary to sacrifice individuals to save the entire state. Marx explicitly says that. He defines justice as whatever will preserve the state. Christians ought to see red flags when they hear that kind of stuff. On the other hand, there's another extreme, and that's individualism. The individualist view of this says the individuals are prior. They come first. Solitary, all-sovereign individuals, independent, come together, meet, and contract to form a state. Almost no states have ever been made that way, but that's the way the theory goes, that that's what is really going on if we could know how states originated at first. But we have now not only to take into consideration the foundational and leading functions, but the relation of citizens to the state. And it's not going to be any different from the relations of individual human beings to any other organization either. Human beings are not parts, mere parts of any institution, such that the institution is more important. It is what the humans depend on. There are other kinds of relationships too that are not part whole. There's a certain kind of bee and a certain kind of plant. The plant can't exist without the bees pollinating them, and the bees can't exist without those plants because that's the only kind of that supplies the food that they eat. So that's a symbiotic kind of relation. In that relation, two things have a capsulate relation but do not combine to form a whole. So there are capsulate relations that form new wholes. There are ones that don't but express some other kind of relationship. So this is an important distinction for getting straight what's wrong with the two main theories that have held the field for so long. And I'm going to put those over here. Collectivism. This says that the institution is primary. It produces the individual members. The members can't really exist or function apart from the whole. Aristotle even adds that any human that separates himself from the rest of society and isn't a member of a state is either a beast or a god, but not a human. Either that person is subhuman, because that person lives outside of the state and all that it affords, primarily justice, but then other cultural advantages, or that person is superhuman and a god. And if a person is like that, Aristotle recommends that that person be banished from the state. That's collectivism. Individualism goes the other route. This says it's the individuals that are primary. They somehow come into being apart from any community of humans, and they are are perfectly capable of maintaining themselves as solitary individuals. The name that's most famously associated with that view is Thomas Hobbes. Hobbes postulates that at the very beginning of the human race, there were just solitary individuals. He doesn't even envision marriage or family. They're solitary individuals, they're in some kind of landscape, they hunt for their food, they have sex whenever they bump into each other, and that's how the race continues. And so far as they are concerned, they don't really need any organization. There is no collective group that they must have. You have to think about that for a moment. Is that really plausible? We all know it takes at least two humans to make another one. We've got to have some kind of community there. But think about what he's suggesting. Is it plausible that individuals can just walk into a landscape and do just fine without the help of any other individuals? That view was made popular by the novel Robinson Crusoe, but if you think about it, it's not all that plausible. Imagine yourself now put into some environment. You've never been there before. There are no other humans. Maybe it's an island someplace that's uninhabited. And you are placed there, and the object is to see if you can survive. Now, are not allowed to have anything that's produced by human society either. Because for Hobbes, there was no society. So each person, if they wore anything, would have to make their own clothes. They'd have to find their own food, and so on. So now you are placed on this island, completely naked and without any tools or remnants of civilization. How are you going to survive? Do you think that would be easy? What do you need to do first? Do you need to make a weapon because there may be an animal hunting you? Do you need to make shoes because it really hurts to walk very much? If you find water, is it pure? Can you drink it? You find berries. Can I eat them or will they poison me? And now imagine that we put several people on this island. This is Hobbes' picture. And they're going to be wandering around trying to do the same thing. Guard themselves, arm themselves, feed themselves. Just how successful do you think they would make out? Especially if they bumped into one another and each considered the other competition. I think it's dreaming to suppose that people could exist as solitary individuals apart from anything produced by humans, a larger group of humans, working together to produce it. But that's what individualism claims. Hobbes' picture then goes on to say these solitary individuals who are self-sufficient come together finally, because that life is pretty unpleasant. He has a famous line about it. Life in the state of nature, the way people first came on the scene, is solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And so they contract together to make a state. They contract together to give somebody that they choose the authority to make laws and to rule. And now, instead of being a war of all against all, in which he has another famous comment that man is a wolf to man, instead of that, we can avoid all that by giving up all our rights to the state and having this newly created authority exercise complete unrestrained power to make laws and enforce them. That's the picture he recommends. And I think that most of us from our own Christian background already have an instinctive revulsion to that. An all-powerful state? That's not what we want to hear. So Locke picks up individualism much later and tries to make it a lot more friendly than that. People contract together to create a state and they give the state authority, but the state only has whatever authority the rest of the people choose to give it, and they designate what that is. So the state, in Locke's view, isn't so all-encompassing and totalitarian, but then it's reduced to little more than a security company. It's a group of people who have the authority to use force to enforce laws, and the laws are there just to protect your life and your property. if there's no broader view, such as what we get from Scripture, that the better thing would be to have the state create an order that has to do with public justice. It has to do with far more than just protecting your property. It has to do with relations between humans, reducing strife, giving ways for conflict resolution, and all sorts of other law besides protecting property. Now, these two theories then both come out with a view of human beings that we're going to argue is not correct and can't be sustained. This says it's the group that's primary, so the individuals, if necessary, must be sacrificed for the good of the group. And as I said, Marx even defines justice as whatever preserves the state. The individualists, in order to avoid that, say, no, it's not the group, it's the individual that's primary. And individuals freely contract together to make whatever institutions they have. It's called the contract theory of the state, not surprisingly. So which of these is more Christian? Which of these is what Christians ought to be saying? The way Ruth says, neither one. They're both false. Now you might say, wait a minute. If the group isn't primary because it produces individuals, or the individuals aren't primary in that they produce any groups, any communities, then what is it? This argument, if it didn't have such serious consequences, might almost be funny. It sounds like the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg? And indeed, it's a lot like that. But what is the biblical answer to this? How do there come to be humans in organizations, in communities? Well, the answer in Scripture is that neither one creates the other. God creates them both simultaneously. So God brings it about. There are human beings, but they're not just the solitary human beings. Brings it about that there are human beings already in relationship, already in marriages, already in families. So neither the group is the sole producer of the individual or the individual of the group. God is the creator of both. There's a text in the Scripture that says God sets solitary individuals in families. That's the prescription, but that's the way it began. So both these rest on imagined fantasies, on stories about how humanity may have originated. And the biblical story is different from both of them. So what we want to say here is that when citizens have a relationship to the state, and they do not have it as parts, not parts of a greater whole, but sub-wholes. That are members of a greater whole. So we are distinguishing here being a part of and of a greater whole and being a sub-whole in a greater whole, and that's what I'm calling a capsulate relationship. And this is our proposal for understanding how humans relate to the communities of which they are, in which they are members or sub-wholes. Why don't we stop there and give you a chance to think this over, and we'll come back and continue it.